Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is now 7:59. Coming up next, Wednesday Talk Radio with host Paul Roland. We invite your calls at 503-231-8187. But first, some announcements.
Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Offbeat sounds for talented listeners. Broadcasts every other Wednesday at 10 p.m.
De nuevo, esta música divina.
There was heaven and there was earth.
Después de esta pieza, vamos a escuchar una comunicación simpática y cruel con Annie.
That's Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Every other Wednesday from 10 to midnight, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Wednesdays for an afternoon of jazz. Hosts of Jazz Lives, A Jazz World, and Jazz in the Afternoon play the very best in jazz music. From the historical to the present, and jazz of all stripes. Swinging, smoking, bluesy, funky, new and old, but all good. That's Wednesday afternoons from noon to 4 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Are you still looking for a way to fit KBOO into your year-end giving? KBOO Community Radio is in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. For the past 11 years, the Give Guide has raised nearly $13 million for hundreds of local nonprofits. Help us reach our $20,000 goal and look KBOO up on the giveguide.org website and make a donation today before December 31st. Remember, we have a one-to-one match for all new and increasing donations, too. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
So come all you people, come and sing with me. Join our voices and sing. say he is the Babylon. Some say he is the Son of God, while others the Son of the Sun. Some may listen in woodland for the call of her, while others they hear the clash of swords, for the old king will return. Return home. So come all you people, come and sing with me. Join our voices and sing the long nights away. All over the land a chorus of voices will sing, for the rising sun on midwinter's day. On midwinter's day.
And good morning. You are whistling. You are listening to KBOO. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm Paul Rowland. I'll be with you for the next hour until 9 o'clock. At which point, as I heard, you may have too, that Ani Haynes will be talking about reconnecting with nature at 9 o'clock on Political Perspectives, which is actually something that I'm going to be talking about today. That song, unfortunately, I don't have who the artist is. If you're interested, give me a call at the front desk afterwards. I'm sure I can find that. I know I played that on my folk show one time. Anyway, a song about the solstice. And we did just have the solstice, and Christmas is coming up. And I'm going to talk about those things and much else. And if you would like to talk about them, give me a call at 503-231-8187. And I would, if you know you're a regular caller to talk radio, you might want to just step back and see who else is out there wanting to call in. If you haven't called in and you're interested in calling in, please do. I'd love to hear from new folks. Love to hear from folks who haven't spoken up too much. Also like to hear from folks who have called in. But today I'd really, really like to hear new voices, if at all possible. So those of you who've listened to my show over the past couple years know I talk a fair amount about co-optation, what I call recuperation and substitution. So I would like to talk about those themes, and they go way, way back, and they go back to the takeover of this holiday period by the Christian Church as a way to exert control over people, over populations, to bring people into the fold of the Mother Church, aka the Roman Empire, when the Empire adopted Christianity as the official state religion and basically co-opted it into the power structure, when originally it was against the power structure. And that's been going on, had been going on before that, and has been going on ever since, and is something that I think we have to pay way more attention to, because sometimes we start doing things, we get involved in fighting certain struggles, and we don't realize that maybe the energy that we're putting into it is at some point becoming misdirected or being co-opted for other aims. Sounds kind of vague, but if you're an activist, I'm sure you know what I mean by that. And we've seen it time and time again. So what is it about Christmas and the solstice? The original celebration goes back thousands and thousands and thousands of years. It goes way back before Mithra, but we know that Mithra was said to have been born on December 25th. That was an ancient Indian and Persian deity, Vedic Indian, and got adopted by the, remained with the Persians when they, I guess, kind of split off with the Indians. And there's many, many similarities between Mithra and Jesus. And so it's only natural. And, you know, it's hard to know exactly what elements of the Christian story of the so-called virgin birth actually did pertain to the historical figure known as Jesus Christ, and what actually was from the previous older mythologies. So the Mithra, the babe, was wrapped in swaddling clothes, placed in a manger and attended by shepherds, considered a great traveling teacher and master, had 12 companions or disciples perform miracles. And Mithra was the sun god, the king of the sun, as you heard in that ode to the solstice. The death and rebirth of the sun was what this was all about. And so, you know, it became the S-O-N of God, the son of God, as opposed to the S-U-N God, or the son of the sun. As the case may be, why is this important? Well, it's important because these institutions, these imperial institutions, whether the Roman Empire or the Roman Church, that got after the end of the official Roman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire carried on, it transitioned into the feudal system, which was dominated by the church. The institutions that we live with today are basically heirs of these institutions. All centralized, bureaucratic, expansionist, imperialist institutions have commonalities, and we are the heirs of those institutions, and so that's why this is important. So the shortest day of the year, obviously very important to anybody in tune with natural cycles, with the either agricultural or herder peoples. Had to pay very, very, very close attention to the natural cycles, to the world that we live in. And Damn the Bard, that's right, I forgot. I knew that. That's on Midwinter's Day by D.A.M.H. the Bard. So that's the music we heard at the beginning. Thank you, Ross, our new engineer of this program, after Steve Nasser for so many years, who still does the other days of the week, except for Friday. Anyway, I was talking about the shortest day of the year, and so the importance of that is, you know, having to pay attention, close attention to the cycles. The people, you know, who lived more outside than we do, who did not have these automobiles that enclose us, did not live so intensely indoors, were not so intensely mediated by technologies, anyway, you get the picture. So people were very much more closely attuned to the natural cycles. And so it was a very dramatic event. The shortest day of the year is very important, marked the, you know, the transition from the ending of the year and the ending of the agricultural year and the rebirth of the sun, the promise of returning warmth, returning light, returning fertility of the earth. The earth goes to sleep in the winter and is reborn in the spring. You know, these aren't just myths. And in fact, it's from what I read, Mithra actually was originally was seen as the material sun itself. So it's hard to rip ourselves out of our current psyches, but I think it is worth trying. I think that's one of the most important things we can do, is to do things that take ourselves out of the immersion we have in this current techno bubble that we live in. That is basically, we're riding seemingly to our own extinction, and to think of a different relationship to the cosmos, to the universe. And so, you know, you think about, if you are living directly off of what the earth provides, and many people saw the earth as a mother, and so, you know, people might have questions about this, might think critically about the idea, the genderization, the gendering of the physical world. It might be seen as problematic, but it's also kind of interesting. There's a certain symmetry and beauty there as well. So it's not too far a stretch to, you know, see this sun, which is such powerful importance in our daily lives here on planet Earth, to eventually personify that as a deity. But what that really means, I don't think we really can understand. You know, the feeling of gratitude, the you know, some people say worship. What does that really mean? Giving thanks to these powerful forces that give us life, that we are subject to, that we do not control. And in fact, the taking over the attempted control of the natural forces is basically what led to the situation that we find ourselves in, the hubris, the idea that we can control nature, control the world. So I've thrown out a lot, and I would like to read from something here before we get going with the calls. Sort of, you know, the theme, you know, the way I look at it, you know, if you just look at the calendar itself, the Christian calendar that was imposed upon earlier, more moon-based cycles, you know, ways of marking time, most primal peoples, most what I call civilized, whatever, pre-industrialized, certainly peoples, mark time by the phases of the moon. And that's, in a way, a much more accurate way of looking at it than this artificial 365-day year. Well, it's not artificial. Obviously, it does mark the Earth going around the sun. But the way that the calendar was imposed, this, I guess what I mean is the years since Jesus was born, this open-ended nature of the calendar, as opposed to just looking at the moons, you know, the idea of, you know, year one, year two, year 2015, this sort of open-ended sort of leads to or falls into this idea of progress, this open-ended, unlimited progress, which is so dangerously deceptive. It makes it seem like we're just sort of on this golden road to perfection. And some people still believe that. So anyway, that idea of it basically creates this fundamental alienation between human beings and the rest of creation. And I know I'm simplifying things, but I just think it's really, now is the time that traditionally, you know, tribal peoples, village-based peoples would tell their oral stories, tell stories to each other, get together, congregate, and reinforce their collective sense of understanding of their place in the cosmos. And we've really lost sight of that with sort of the massification of society. So anyway, with the you know, the twin themes that I'd like to take on today of the specific day, the time period we're in, the transition, the solstice, you know, the death and rebirth, to the greater situation in which it seems like having ripped ourselves from these natural cycles created this myth of progress, this control of the natural forces, this channelization of natural energies, this domestication of species, domestication of ourselves, the urbanization, the technological developments that we're kind of trapped on this treadmill of unending technological innovation. It has, you know, led to this massive use of fossil fuel energy, which has created basically a cosmic crisis that we're caught in. You know, we're actually, some people think, and I tend to believe this, that we are actually coming to some sort of ending of a phase of our existence that was inaugurated by the separation of the human species from the rest. So I'm going to read a little bit from this Roy Scranton, who's the author of Learning to Die in the Anthropocene, Reflections on the End of a Civilization. He writes for the New York Times, The Nation, Rolling Stone, and elsewhere. And this is from the New York Times Online. It's called "We're Doomed, Now What?" The time we've been thrown into is one of alarming and bewildering change. The breakup of the post-1945 global order, a multi-species mass extinction, and the beginning of the end of civilization as we know it. Not one of us is innocent, not one of us is safe. The world groans under the weight of 7 billion humans. Every new birth adds another mouth hungry for food, another life greedy for energy. And of course, I would emphasize that it obviously does make a difference where you're born and what society you live in. There's some societies like our own that have a disproportionate hunger for food and energy, or greed, or whatever you want to might call it. And I'll continue with Roy Scranton's article. "We might wish we could take Nietzsche's place. He had to cope only with the death of God. We all see what's happening. We read it in the headlines every day. But seeing isn't believing, and believing isn't accepting. We respond according to our prejudices, acting out of instinct, reflex, and training. Right-wing denialists insist that climate change isn't happening, or that it isn't caused by humans, or that the real problem is terrorism or refugees, while left-wing denialists insist that the problems are fixable, under our control, merely a matter of political will. Accelerationists argue that more technology is the answer. Incrementalists tell us to keep trusting the same institutions and leaders that have been failing us for decades. Activists say we have to fight, even if we're sure to lose. Meanwhile, as the gap between the future we're entering and the future we once imagined grows ever wider, nihilism takes root in the shadow of our fear. If all is already lost, nothing matters anymore. You can feel this nihilism in TV shows like True Detective, The Leftovers, The Walking Dead, and Game of Thrones. And you can see it in the rush to war, sectarianism, and racial hatred. It defines our current moment, though in truth it's nothing new. The Western world has been grappling with radical nihilism since at least the 17th century, when scientific insights into human behavior began to undermine religious belief. Philosophers have struggled since to fill the gap between fact and meaning. Kant tried to reconcile empiricist determinism with God and reason. Bresson and Peirce worked to merge Darwinian evolution and human creativity. More recent thinkers glean the stripped furrows neuroscience has left to logic and language. Scientific materialism, taken to its extreme, threatens us with meaninglessness. If consciousness is reducible to the brain and our actions are determined not by will but by causes, then our values and beliefs are merely rationalizations for the things we are going to do anyway. Most people find this view of human life repugnant, if not incomprehensible. In her recent book of essays, The Givenness of Things, Marilynne Robinson rejects the materialist view of consciousness, arguing for the existence of the human soul by insisting that the soul's metaphysical character makes it impervious to materialist arguments. The soul, writes Robinson, is an intuition that, quote, cannot be dispelled by proving the soul's physicality, from which it is aloof by definition. And on these same grounds, its non-physicality is no proof for its non-existence. The biologist E.O. Wilson spins the problem differently. Does free will exist, he asks, in the meaning of human existence? Yes, if not in ultimate reality, then at least in the operational sense necessary for sanity and therefore for the perpetuation of the human species. Robinson offers an appeal to ignorance, Wilson an appeal to consequences. Both arguments are fallacious. Yet, as Wilson suggests, our dogged insistence on free agency makes a kind of evolutionary sense. Indeed, humanity's keenest evolutionary advantage has been its drive to create collective meaning. That drive is as ingenious as it is relentless, and it can find a way to make sense of despair, depression, catastrophe, genocide, war, disaster, plagues, and even the humiliations of science. Our drive to make meaning is powerful enough even to turn nihilism against itself. As Friedrich Nietzsche, one of Western philosophy's most incisive diagnosticians of nihilism, wrote near the end of the 19th century, man, obviously humanity, I would say, will sooner will nothingness than not will. This dense aphorism builds on one of the thoughts at the core of Nietzsche's philosophy, today so widely accepted as to be almost unrecognizable, that human beings make their own meaning out of life. In this view, there is no ultimate transcendent moral truth, or as Nietzsche put it in an early essay on truth and lies in a non-moral sense, truth is no more than a mobile army of metaphors, metonyms, and anthropomorphisms. If we can stomach the moral vertigo this idea might induce, we can also see how it's not necessarily nihilistic, but in the right light as testament rather to human resilience. And I'm going to jump ahead a little bit here. Again, this article is called We're Doomed, Now What? By Roy Scranton. This doesn't speak directly for me, but I think there's a lot that I find very stimulating in this essay. I find it's worth putting out there. And again, number is 503-231-8187. If you want to jump in here while I read this. Nietzsche wasn't himself a nihilist. He developed his idea of truth as a mobile army of metaphors into a more complex philosophy of perspectivism, which conceived of subjective truth as a variety of constructions arising out of particular perspectives on objective reality. The more perspectives we learn to see from, the more truth we have access to. This is different from relativism, with which it's often confused, which says that all truth is relative and there is no objective reality. Fundamentally, Nietzsche was an empiricist who believed that beyond all of our interpretations, there was at last something we call the world, even if we can never quite apprehend it objectively. Quote, even great spirits have only their five fingers' breadth of experience, he writes. Just beyond it, their thinking ceases and their endless empty space and stupidity begins. Nietzsche's positive philosophical project, what he called his gay science, was to create the conditions for the possibility of a human being who could comprehend the meaninglessness of our drive to make meaning, yet nonetheless affirm human existence, a human being who could learn amor fati, the love of one's fate. This was his much understood idea of the overman. Nietzsche labored mightily to create this new human ideal for philosophy because he needed it so badly himself. A gloomy, sensitive pessimist and self-declared decadent who eventually went mad, he struggled all his life to convince himself that his life was worth living. Today, as every hour brings new alarms of war and climate disaster, we might wish we could take Nietzsche's place. He had to cope only with the death of God, after all, while we must come to terms with the death of our world. Peril lurks on every side, from the delusions of hope to the fury of reaction, from the despondency of hopelessness to the promise of destruction. We stand today on a precipice of annihilation that Nietzsche could not have even imagined. There's little reason to hope that we'll be able to slow down global warming before we pass a tipping point. We're already 1 degree Celsius above pre-industrial temperatures, and there's another half a degree baked in. The West Antarctic ice sheet is collapsing, Greenland is melting, permafrost across the world is liquefying, and methane has been detected leaking from seafloors and Siberian craters. It's probably already too late to stop these feedbacks, which means it's probably already too late to stop apocalyptic planetary warming. Meanwhile, the world slides into hate-filled, bloody havoc like the last act of a particularly ugly Shakespearean tragedy. Accepting our situation could easily be confused with nihilism. In a nation founded on hope, built with can-do Yankee grit, and bedazzled by its own technological wizardry, the very idea that something might be beyond our power or that humans have intrinsic limits verges on blasphemy. Right and left, millions of Americans believe that every problem has a solution. Suggesting otherwise stirs a deep and often hostile resistance. It's not so much that accepting the truth of our situation means thinking the wrong thought, but rather thinking the unthinkable. An anthology of essays from the Times Philosophy Series. That was a little advertisement in the Times that I didn't delete there. Yet it's just at this moment of crisis that our human drive to make meaning reappears as our only salvation. If we're willing to reflect consciously on the ways we make life meaningful, on how we decide what is good, what our goals are, what's worth living or dying for, and what we do every day, day to day, and how we do it. Because if it's true that we make our lives meaningful ourselves and not through revealed wisdom handed down by God or the market or history, then it's also true that we hold within ourselves the power to change our lives wholly, utterly, by changing what our lives mean. Our drive to make meaning is more powerful than oil, the atom, and the market. And it's up to us to harness that power to secure the future of the human species. We can't do it by clinging to the progressivist, profit-seeking, technology-can-fix-it ideology of fossil-fueled capitalism. We can't do it by trying to control the future. We need to learn to let our current civilization die, to accept our mortality and practice humility. We need to work together to transform a global order of meaning focused on accumulation into a new order of meaning that knows the value of limits, transience, and restraint. More important, we need to give up defending and protecting our truth, our perspective, our Western values, and understand that truth is found not in one perspective, but in their multiplication. Not in one point of view, but in the aggregate. Not in opposition, but in the whole. We need to learn to see not just with Western eyes, but with Islamic eyes and Inuit eyes. Not just with human eyes, but with golden-cheeked warbler eyes, coho salmon eyes, and polar bear eyes. And not even just with eyes at all, but with the wild, barely articulate being of clouds and seas and rocks and trees and stars. We were born on the eve of what may be the human world's greatest catastrophe. None of us chose this, not deliberately. None of us can choose to avoid it either. Some of us will even live through it. What meaning we pass on to the future will depend on how well we remember those who have come before us, how wisely and how gently we're able to shed the ruinous ways of life, way of life that's destroying us today, and how consciously we're able to affirm our role as creators of our fated future. Accepting the fatality of our situation isn't nihilism, but rather the necessary first step in forging a new way of life, between self-destruction and giving up, between willing nothingness and not willing. There is another choice, willing our fate. Conscious self-creation, we owe it to the generations whose futures we've burned and wasted to build a bridge, to be a bridge, to connect the diverse human traditions of meaning-making in our past to those survivors, children of the Anthropocene, who will build a new world among our ruins. Well, that was quite something. We're doomed. Now what? It kind of seems like I've been working up to that for months now. That particular essay, Roy Scranton. I thank you and applaud you. And I think it all kind of fits together here. You know, it's the dying sun, the rebirth of the sun, the dying civilization, the rebirth of something. I remember I've quoted somebody who said, you know, we're born, you know, before the final death of an old world and the creation of a new one. And it's a difficult time. So if any of this resonates with you, I certainly don't want to just keep talking to myself here. I'd love to hear from what you have to say on this couple days after solstice, couple days before so-called Christmas. I was talking about Mithra, the origins of this Christmas day, the co-optation of the ancient so-called pagan worldview by the so-called Christian worldview. Of course, you know, the early Christians, I don't believe, called themselves Christians. They were just trying to continue a community of spirit that was begun, you know, in opposition to the, you know, mechanical, imperial, institutional spirit that had descended upon the earth in the Roman Empire and, of course, was the heir of the earlier Assyrians, Hittites, the earlier empire cultures, which, gosh, only started about 6,000 to 8,000 years ago. Anyway, that's what I want to talk about. I'm going to go to a musical break here if I don't hear anybody call in. 503-231-8187. Let's hear that song queued up on the turntable there, Ross.
For the life that was spoken, for the blood that we have spilled, for the treaties that were broken, for the leaders you have still.
Yes.
'Cause to die. To die for your sins, for the tribes you terminated, for the myths you keep alive, for the land you confiscated, for freedom.
And we're back. Custer Died for Your Sins by Floyd Westerman. Thank you, Floyd. And we have our first caller. Helen is on the line. Go ahead, Helen.
Well, I just want to say good for you reading something so important that is every sentence is such a deep thought that I can't really make any more comment on it, but it's the second time that I've been reading on KABU, because last week one of the ladies read something on the radio, which was amazing. And could you please be sure that you have it on today? If I look in KABU on the computer, the name of the article?
I will do that. But so, I mean, you know, how about the feelings that this brought up? The idea, you know, we're doomed, now what?
Well, we have to try to hit people over the head to have them wake up before everything else wakes them up. But I don't know. I think we'll get there anyway, just because it's... you know, like seeds get into the ground all by themselves and grow. I mean, I just feel the world is going to get in a better place. But I do want to say that I live out in the country, and so I often go to McMinnville, and I'm just naturally needing to smile at people. And, of course, in the country, people smile back. And also, I feel wherever I go, if I see something or somebody, I suppose it's mostly women, but guys too, that I will compliment them maybe on their hair or their outfits or something. In fact, yesterday I was in a store at Barber, on Barber Boulevard, and this tall young man was going to help me check out, and I just saw that he was so cold, and I said, you're cold, aren't you? And he said, yes. He said, I forgot my jacket. And I said, go and borrow somebody's jacket. And then as I was leaving, I saw the manager of the store, one of them. They're Middle Eastern people that are very nice. They're like uncles. I said, the guy is cold who's working. Can you help him? And he says, yes, we have jackets upstairs. I'll get him one. And I think if everybody tries, like, for a moment every day, if they're out to do something good and kind, it will spread, and maybe something good will happen.
All right. Wonderful thought. Thank you for that, Helen.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So, one thing is just, you know, try to overcome or, you know, work through whatever we're going through ourselves. And it's, you know, not always easy. Some of us are in very, very difficult situations. To the best that we're able to, reach out to other people, and especially those who are having difficulties, as Helen said. And so, who's our next caller? Camilo, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
What you've shared already has raised a couple of thoughts with me. The first one is about Christmas. I went to hear Handel's Messiah at the Schnitz, and they handed out a booklet with all of the words to the Messiah. And I don't know if people pay attention other than to the Hallelujah chorus, but if you pay close attention, what you learn, and this relates to what you were saying about how Christianity has co-opted the authority that government had, what the Messiah says is that this was the meaning of the birth of Christ, to come over and assume the realm of the king and the ultimate authority. And what's striking about the words of the Messiah is how militaristic, how militant, and how fiercely aggressive they are. And I couldn't help but thinking that it doesn't sound any different from what ISIS is saying, just in terms of control through the power of the authority and their absolute potential to rule over the world. And I thought that was a striking aspect, and how it's what's celebrated every year at Christmas time, even if lately it's become commercialized.
I hadn't mentioned, which I think is fairly common knowledge, but the idea Christ apparently was actually born most likely in springtime, and so it was a very artificial imposition. That's one thing I hadn't gotten to, the date of December 25th, and again the reason being is that was such an important date for the so-called pagan, the Mithra. The Romans still actually celebrated the Sol Invictus. Actually, was kind of the day celebration, and the Saturnalia, which took place around this time until January 6th, I believe. Anyway, yeah. It's hard to put maybe if you're like me, it's hard to put ourselves in the mindset of imperialists. You know, it's like the people who are in these on the top of the pyramid and having this power. It's kind of easier to be. Unless you're in that position, it's kind of easy to fall into it, because, how do you, it seems, that's why Native Americans, tribal peoples who were subject to the furies of this civilization had no idea really of that kind of mentality. What was that imperial mentality? It's a strange force.
Well, I think a way to think about it is to recognize that it embodies struggle. And clearly the pageant of Christ represents how threatening Christianity was to the Roman Empire.
Exactly.
That's the reason that he was killed, because he was a political threat. And I think that there is a biological aspect to this struggle, because what biology ultimately relies upon is some degree of tribalism. I mean, we all are parts of different species, and they struggle against one another for survival. And I think that the problems that we face have to do with morality extending only as far as your tribe, and that morality justifies anything for the sake of the survival of the tribe.
Well, I want to push back against that, because I think it's a really important thing that we don't look at enough. So I think that view of what a quote tribe is, I think we have to be very wary about that, because the quote tribes lived in proximity and together for thousands of years here in North America, so they must have had some way of relating to each other that didn't escalate to the point of domination and genocide. So I think that notion of tribalism that you're saying might be a product of the thinking of empire itself.
Well, I think I'm using the term tribe in a little more generalized way, as in the author of the piece that you read points out that you need to view the world from the eyes of the other, and simply tribe means the other, and it's what allows us to in effect dehumanize the other in order to make him the victim of our struggle for dominance.
Right. I guess what I'm saying is I think there was a sense of the different people, I guess you'd call them better peoples, perhaps tribal might be a sort of a Western construct, but different peoples that you know, had they had a sense of a multiplicity of peoples, that they were just one amongst many peoples, and so that they were able to handle that, apparently, because, you know, they had very complex social relationships. It's within imperial culture that you get the sense of denying the very existence of the other.
Well, I think that the concept of peoples has to be considered broadly too, because they may not necessarily be ethnic or national. They can also be based on belief, and that's the way that some tribes form their boundaries, is through their belief concepts. And I think one belief concept that is really kind of a problem in trying to how to sort this out is that the struggle has to do with what happens not on Earth but in the afterlife. And I think it's very, very difficult to figure out how do you contend with a belief system where life in the real world is not as important as life in the afterworld.
Well, that raises a whole other set of important questions. But I do notice that we've got a couple more callers, and there's always this tension between wanting to continue this conversation, which has been very interesting with you, for another 5-10 minutes, but also wanting to respect other callers calling in. So I'm going to have to let you go, Camilo. I appreciate
it. I've said my piece. Thank you.
Thank you, Camilo.
Bye.
And that whole issue is very interesting, and I'd like to pursue that if we can. Let's see what our next caller has to say. James, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Hello.
Hello. So I like where that last little bit was going. The Roman Empire just absorbed a lot of things. You know, the what we know as Christmas is really just an amalgamation of different beliefs from different people. But somehow somebody thinks that, you know, they should have one say over the other. And that's, you know, if we're gonna truly live as a united people in these states, you know, we got to realize that, you know, even just the things that we, that they're really, that the things that we think have definition, it's really just a bunch of different folks' beliefs put together. But I think more importantly, you know, he was right about the afterlife. And I think if we, you know, because you were talking about how the tribe here in North America live next to each other for thousands of years without the same type of genocide we've seen in other places. And I think it's really what it comes down to is realizing that all of our gods are cultural. You know, our view of the afterlife is shaped by the...
Well, listen, James, you're breaking up a little bit.
And I'm sorry.
And that's okay. And I know you call in a fair amount, so I know we've got a couple other callers. I'd like to maybe give some other people who don't get a chance to call in too much. But thank you for calling in today.
Okay.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Harvey, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Paul. Well, I have a novel concept to share with you and your audience. And it's that I believe that we're being birthed into space. And it's like a real birth. You know, the walls close in. You're being squeezed out of the comfortable womb into the world. And I think we humans are being birthed into the stars. And it's fly or die, you know, the population size, the lack of resources. And all arrows seem to be pointing that way to me. It's pushing us. Because when we're comfortable, we just stay where we are. But it is a birth.
Who's comfortable?
Exactly. We're being birthed into the universe here. And all we have to do is overcome a couple technologies like if we can find some sort of repulsive force that can work for us, instead of an attractive force like gravity being a repulsive force, that we could utilize that to start offloading off the planet.
So you're an accelerationist, as Roy Scranton, in Roy Scranton's terms.
Well, it just seems like a natural phenomenon.
A natural phenomenon. What do you mean by natural?
Well, Earth is mama. That's when we come from the cradle. But in a sense, it's like birds. You can't stay in the nest that long. It's fly or die. And where's left to go? I look around the options. The next place to go is up into space. And recently, President Obama, they told space miners that whatever they find on asteroids or the moon, they can keep. We're seeing the corporate competition starting to warm up. It's everything's heading towards space.
Hey,
and
Harvey.
I think once we're in space, we can start looking at the Earth as the garden that it is, and we can sort of offload some of that pressure. But I think that's the way.
Hey, do you ever see the film Brazil?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, there's this you know, the last scene where the guy's like, he finally gets his fantasy. He gets the girl, and lives happily ever after. But the reality is, it's this projection, it's this like psychic projection, based on the fact that he's actually being tortured. I think the kind of fantasies, this kind of techno fantasy you're pointing at, that's kind of like I see the parallel to that film Brazil. It's like it's this desperate psychic projection from a world that has become, that we can't actually resolve the contradictions, the cognitive dissonance of what we've created. So we have to create these desperate technological fantasies that can create this escapist, we can actually escape from what we've actually created. That's my take on it.
That's the way it always seems to go. Like when they left Britain and the Mayflower there, they didn't go because they were going on a pleasure cruise, I'm telling you. They went out to sea in those in those little ships because they were escaping what they had, and that found America.
Yeah,
so
we're doing it again.
We're going with our ships out there.
Yeah, then they did to the Pequod. Do you ever read what they did to the Pequods? War.
Yes.
Yeah, the Native American I believe it was the Narragansetts who they enlisted to fight with them. They at a certain point, when they were just like slaying children and women and everybody in a vicious, ruthless way, the Narragansetts, they left the field of battle. They're like, no, it's too much. We can't take this. What was wrong with those people? Why were they so desperately, why were they killing so desperately? What's wrong with our culture?
There's no end to the tooth and nail. It just goes on and story.
Oh, the myth of the tooth and nail, yeah, right.
But amongst that, there is something bigger here, and I think we are star children. I think our place is in the universe, and I think this is the way it happens. We're getting squeezed off the earth, and it's a horrific event.
You can keep dreaming your desperate dream, Harvey.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for calling. All right. Barth, we got another caller here. Barth, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Couple of things. The peaceful coexistence depends a lot on carrying capacity. I think it's naive to say that all of the native peoples in this continent got along swimmingly together and each went in their little bubble. I mean, there certainly was cooperation, multi-state trade interactions, but some were quite violent. There was a lot of slave taking in certain areas. There was heavy wars of attrition recently discovered in Alaska for when resources got scarce. Rather.
Well, of course, there is conflict, and there is what you might call warfare, but it was. Yeah, sure. I mean, I don't mean to re-mythologize or justify, excuse, defend or anything. No, I'm just saying that you can't deny that they actually a wide diversity of peoples did in one way or another coexist on this continent for thousands of years, which is different than what happened since. I mean,
agreed.
Basic fact is what I'm pointing to.
Well, the thing about that is carrying capacity is one of the hallmarks there, but
what does that mean? What does that mean, carrying capacity? It's something in their culture allowed there's a certain internal dynamic to their cultures which did not allow for the kind of expansionism and domination and genocidal expansionism that happened in our culture. There's some fundamentally different cultural mechanism going on.
Well,
it's not some abstract carrying capacity. It's something within the culture itself.
Well, carrying capacity is not abstract, but that's another argument. The thing that makes this work and the thing that hopefully will help us make it work in the future is understanding the biodynamic in which we live, understanding the needs of cooperatively of what is required for a useful, functional life for regular folks, cooperation versus competition, and frankly, taking the huge spectrum out of income and political control that exists now. It's if you, you know, don't cut down the forests, but you selectively log them, for example, then you have forests and you have all the benefits of forest.
Right.
If you don't eat all the fish, then you have more fish.
Sure. We all know that the problem is that there's a dynamic that is going, and that dynamic is what needs to stop. And it doesn't seem like, you know, I can name all these prescriptive things that I think would solve everything too. But the problem is there's this dynamic of hierarchical power and control that we are not getting at. But we have one more caller and we only have 4 minutes left. So I got to let you go. So thanks for calling in. Let's give Barbara a chance here. Go ahead, Barbara, you're on the air.
Good morning. I wanted to call earlier and just suggest a book that's a pretty basic, easy read, but a wonderful piece. It's Living in the Shadow of the Cross, Understanding and Resisting the Power and Privilege of Christian Hegemony by Paul Cavell. And I think he'd make a wonderful guest maybe around the next Christian holiday.
Living in the Shadow of the Cross.
Living in the Shadow of the Cross. And it's very interesting, the daily language that we use, how much of it is rooted in Christianity. It just is amazing just how much that we take for granted of our language. And that's just the beginning. It's about decolonizing your mind and your heart. So it's a good read, even for Christians.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the show. You have a good day. Bye-bye.
Okay. And I would also recommend all the books by Vine Deloria. Custer Died for Your Sins, that song we played a bit of, is a book that he wrote. What's the book he wrote about religion? I can't remember right now. But let's go to our next caller. Hello? Hello?
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was thinking about how recently the city council passing the measure to ban any more fossil fuel infrastructure and everything, and how that can have a cascade domino effect with a lot of other areas and towns and everything. And we could do that with the next mayor of Portland, get somebody who's really ultra environmentally conscious, and then put in place all kinds of revolutionary like environmental programs just here in the city of Portland. If you get a mayor that really pushes that, and then that could have a cascade domino effect, should be a model to other places, and really push geothermal. We could build dozens and dozens and dozens of geothermal plants right here in the Portland area, and that would provide a huge amount of electricity power. And then solar farms, geothermal solar farms, invest millions in solar farms.
Don't you think the first thing we need to do is actually stop using so much energy?
Well, sure, yeah. You combine all these things, conservation, new technologies, new buildings that are more efficient, everything under the gamut. But everyone's saying, well, what alternative? Well, you have to provide some alternatives. Geothermal, nobody ever talks about geothermal. It's totally clean. It runs 24 hours instead of wind and solar, which have down periods. You can get geothermal power 24 hours. It's clean and it's abundant all over the country, all over the place. And
so you're saying, as contrary to the what I read, that you're saying that there are actually solutions. Because actually, Roy Scranton was, you know, fundamentally saying that.
I also think we're pretty screwed environmentally. But this could provide us a few more years, maybe.
Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, we got to run. We only have a minute left, and I got to get out of here. But thank you so much for calling.
Yes.
And thank you, everybody who called. And look forward to talking to you next week. This has been Wednesday Talk Radio with your host, Paul Rowland. Have a good day.
For the spirit of solstice is still living here. We'll count all our blessings while the mother lays down with snow as her blanket covering the ground. Thanks to the mother for the life that she brings. She'll wake into warm us again in the spring. The poor and the hungry, the sick and the lost, these are our children, no matter the cost. Come by the fire, the harvest to share, for the spirit of solstice is still living here. A fire is burning, the long night draws near. All who need comfort are welcome by here. Dance 'neath the stars and toast the past year, for the spirit of solstice is still living here.
I'm Monica Beamer.
And I'm Mike Crenshaw. We're KBOO's new Coast Station managers. We're excited to be a part of the KBOO community. We're starting a new weekly feature on Wednesdays at 5:45 p.m. News from the Boo will give you an inside look into what's happening at KBOO, including upcoming events, station news, special programming, and future goals and plans for the station.
Be sure to tune in this